4. Just days after the election, Senator Dan Coats, an Indiana Republican, also received a call from Pence, one of his closest friends and confidants. A calm and gentlemanly devout Christian, the 73-year-old Coats had served 16 years in the Senate. "You want a job?" Pence, a born-again Christian himself, asked Coats. "No, no," Coats said. "I don't want a job." Pence knew Coats was on a different path. Pence, when governor of Indiana, had invited Coats and his wife Marcia to stop by for dinner with him and his wife Karen at Ains House, the governor's retreat, in a rolling, wooded area about 45 minutes outside Indianapolis in Brown County. Religion was a central force in Coats' life. Dan and Marcia had met at Wheaton College, an evangelical liberal arts college in Illinois, 50 years earlier. The Wheaton College motto is, "For Christ and His Kingdom." Evangelist Billy Graham was a dominant and abiding influence at the school. In a lengthy prayer session, the four agreed they needed to make some decisions about their futures. Should Pence run for president or a second term as governor? Should Coats seek another term in the Senate? "We talked about the future and where God might lead each of us," Coats later explained. "We prayed that God would be clear, and I think I raised the question that we should pray for clarity, not for what we want, but clarity for what God would want." Coats did not believe any of them had a special line to God. "It is just simply built into our faith that ultimately we are His children, and He has a plan for us. And we don't know what it is, and our job is to be obedient, to ask for clarity, and then to fulfill it." Pence recounted the Old Testament story of David, who was hiding from King Saul in a cave when God sent a spider to weave a web across the cave opening. On seeing the web, Saul did not enter the cave. The spider had concealed David's presence and saved his life. The story showed that even a spider might be an instrument of great salvation in the hand of God. Marcia Coats, whose grandparents were ministers, had never heard a sermon as serious and deep. The story raised obvious questions. Could a spider, normally a cause for fear, bring salvation? By the end of the dinner, two decisions emerged. Coats would not run for another Senate term after his term ended, and Pence would not run for president. Pence's unexpected selection as Trump's running mate had taken them all by surprise. In their post-election call, Pence proposed Coats come speak to Trump even if he did not want a job. He could describe how the Senate works. Coats had been around long enough to know this was a recruitment tactic dressed up as a request for wise guidance. Coats bit anyway. In late November, he traveled to see the president-elect at Trump Tower in New York City. Coats was uneasy. When the Access Hollywood tape revealing Trump's lewd comments about women surfaced during the campaign, Coats had blasted his party's nominee on Twitter. "Donald Trump's vulgar comments are totally inappropriate and disgusting." "So, you want a job," said Trump, acting as if he was unaware of or didn't care about Coates' earlier comments. "No, no, I don't want a job." "How about becoming an ambassador?" "I've been an ambassador," Coates said. He had served 4 years as ambassador to Germany for George W. Bush. "How about Russia or China?" Trump asked, suggesting that would be a promotion. Coats explained he had been banned from Russia several years earlier because of his vocal criticism of the Russian invasion of Crimea. "That's great," Trump said, adding, "We'll send you to Russia and that'll really stick it to them." Trump was clearly basking in his role as the future president. Just then, Trump was informed that Harold Hamm, a billionaire Oklahoma oil man and big Trump money man, had arrived. "Bring him in," Trump said. "The more people around, the better," it seemed. "This guy, he sticks a straw in the ground and up comes fucking oil," Trump said. "Wherever he drills, he finds oil." The discussion quickly turned away from Coats to Hamm. Almost as an afterthought, Trump said he would call Coates about a job. Coates left Trump Tower and didn't hear anything for a few months. But a month after their meeting, Pence phoned again. "The president would like you to be director of national intelligence." Coates paused. The role, often referred to in its abbreviation DNI or as the intelligence czar, had been created in the wake of the massive information and coordination failures before the 9/11 terrorist attacks. This was one of the biggest jobs the president could offer, the top position in the intelligence world, overseeing 17 intelligence agencies, including the CIA and the National Security Agency, which intercepted worldwide communications. As a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Coates knew the post of DNI would virtually guarantee him admission to the president's national security inner circle and the very center of the central nervous system of the American espionage establishment and its secrets. Still, Coates was reluctant. Marcia urged him to take the job. "Such an awesome position, and powerful, and kind of frightening," she said. She understood her husband's uneasiness about Trump. He had split the Republican Party. Republican members of her own family had told her before the election they could not vote for Trump, even when he looked like the presumptive nominee. Marcia was the sole Republican committeewoman for Indiana, appointed by Pence 3 years earlier. She asked her family members, "Who are you going to vote for then?" "We probably won't vote," they said. "That's not right," she said. "They were Republicans. As Americans, you need to vote, and that's part of what living in a democracy is all about." One outspoken relative said of Trump, "He's not a Christian. He's not a nice person. He's not a moral man." By then, Marcia had sorted out her own position on Trump. Privately, she knew he was, as she put it, a philanderer and a womanizer, no doubt about that. Trump was pro-life, however, and he had promised to fund a stronger military. The family would not budge. As committeewoman, she needed to deliver the state of Indiana to the Republicans. And after Trump won the Indiana primary, Marcia Coates weighed in with a stark declaration of her endorsement in a public letter to fellow Indiana Republicans. "I fear if we do not unite to support Donald Trump, we will again open the door for at least another 4 years of Washington implementing a left-wing agenda," she wrote. "Conservatives stand to lose not only the White House and control of the executive agencies, but also the Supreme Court. As a conservative, pro-life, evangelical female Republican, I understand the conflict many in our party feel about supporting Donald Trump. Trump was not my first or even my second choice. He is not a humble man. I truly believe the office will change Donald Trump. I believe it will humble him, and I think even Donald will be impelled to turn to God for guidance." Dan Coates had even handed a copy of his wife's open letter to Trump when the Republican nominee was in Indiana. Later, Trump ran into Marcia Coates and promised, "I won't let you down." He put his arm around her and said to others there in a friendly, warm way, "She scolded me." "Trump is so controversial," she later said to an associate. "He's the kind of person that would inspire crazy people." Dan Coates accepted the DNI post. He concluded Pence was trying to seed the Trump cabinet with allies, people who shared his religious values, and he agreed to be nominated. As a former senator, he was easily confirmed in an 85-12 vote. Real life set in immediately. Security personnel tore up the Coates' Northern Virginia home to set up a sensitive compartmented information facility, SCIF, in the basement of their three-story house to handle the most important and highly classified information. Cameras and a sophisticated security system also were installed, and intelligence and security personnel began manning the basement SCIF around the clock. Outside, security teams in 12-hour shifts sat in a car in front of their house. privacy no longer existed. With all the people and apparatuses, Coates and his wife even worried that they were being spied on. Soon after starting the job and attending his third intelligence briefing to the president, the president's daily brief, Coates asked for some time alone with Trump. "Mr. President," Coates said, "there will be times when I will be walking in here to brief you on intelligence, and you're not going to be happy with what I have to say." That was his job, and he wanted the president to know it was not personal. Coates felt the declaration sort of freed him up. In his first 3 months as DNI, Coates felt utterly overwhelmed. The intelligence culture was radically different from his world. His liberal arts and law degree background had been just right for the Senate. But the intelligence community was dominated by scientists, engineers, and mathematicians, all driving the extraordinary technology of modern intelligence collection. Everyone talked in acronyms, code words, and ever-increasing levels of classification and special compartments for sensitive programs. Intel was rolling in from outer space to the sea bottom and everywhere in between. Adding to the disorientation, Coates never knew which Trump he'd find in residence when he walked into the Oval Office 3 times a week for the president's daily brief. The PDB was designed to give and showcase the most useful inside and high-level sensitive intelligence about national security issues. Some days, Trump would be in a fine mood, even good. Other days, Trump would lash out abusively. "I don't trust the intelligence," he said, making it clear he saw the intelligence people as enemies. To help reduce the stress, Marcia fixed nice dinners with wine, a special pleasure because they had once signed pledges at Wheaton College not to drink. "Was it a good day or a bad day?" she would ask carefully, but with intense curiosity. "It was a good meeting today," he said sometimes. "The president listened, asked good questions. Trump was smart and could be engaging and even charming." Then there were bad days. The president didn't really want to hear the information, or if he heard it, he would disagree with it, say, "I don't believe that." Coates had hours of reading to finish at night, and the travel was nonstop. He'd regularly spend 23 or 24 hours on a plane to go to and get back from a conference in Singapore, for example. The difference between his old friend Pence's relationship to the intelligence agencies and Trump's was stark. Pence visited all the U.S. intelligence agencies, spending 2 or 3 hours wanting to learn, building up morale. Trump turned down Coates's invitations to tour the NSA or elsewhere. Determined to convince the president of the intelligence agency's worth, Coates decided to bring the intelligence directors to the Oval Office. He asked each, "What are your crown jewels of collection?" He was looking for the incredible stuff that gave the United States a degree of security unimaginable to an outsider. Trump responded best when Coates brought a Navy submarine captain to the Oval Office. The handsome, charismatic officer looked like a movie star. He described top-secret programs that could track the submarines of Russia and China. In another program, United States submarines could pick up expended missiles off the bottom of the ocean that had been launched by adversaries. "Whoa," Trump said, "that guy's really something." But the bad days were more frequent. Coates began to think Trump was impervious to facts. Trump had his own facts. Nearly everyone was an idiot, and almost every country was ripping off the United States. The steady stream of ranting was debilitating. The tension never abated, and Coates would not bend facts to suit the president's preconceptions or desires. Coates was shocked. Trump was on a different page than just about anything I believed in. Trump's habit of tweeting at all hours of the day and night, including about important foreign policy matters, was personally disruptive for Coates. He found himself waking up in the middle of the night thinking, "Oh my God, what has he tweeted?" Finally, Coates decided he would look at the tweets in the morning, concluding he could not let himself get in the habit of thinking he had to wake up at 2 or 3 a.m. just to see if there were any tweets. It was also clear to Coates that the tweeting meant Trump was not sleeping. What were the president's sleep hours? Coates heard the president was starting his workday later and later, now 11:30 a.m. Maybe that was a clue. Marcia was stunned at her husband's reports about the president's arrogance. Who could go into this office of being president and not realize how inadequate they are? Anybody would feel like they needed divine help in order to tackle that job and do it well. Marcia, who had a degree in psychology and had once had a family counseling practice, worried that her husband was dragging. He was losing weight. His shirts were hanging loosely on his body. "Dan," she said one night, "you're going to be a failure at this job if you don't start eating and sleeping and believing in yourself. You are disrespecting God. God put you here." "If you are not doing the job," she said, "you are letting down not just the country or Trump." Being director of national intelligence was part of God's plan for him. He was letting God down. Marcia was tired of his complaining. "You wouldn't be in this position if the Lord didn't believe you were the right man for the job."